weeks. Chevy knew all the fishermen, captains, and deckhands, and they loved to talk. If an American woman who lived with the Indians suddenly arrived in town, they would know it. Nate searched until the end of the week. He walked the streets, watched the crowds, checked out hotel lobbies and sidewalk cafes, looked at the faces, and saw no one even remotely resembling Rachel. At 1, on his last day, he stopped at Valdir's office and collected his passport. They said goodbye like old friends and promised to see each other soon. Both knew it would never happen. At 2, Chevy drove him to the airport. They sat in the departure lounge for half an hour, watching as the only plane was unloaded, then prepped for reboarding. Chevy wanted to spend time in the U.S. and needed Nate's help. "I'll need a job," he said. Nate listened with sympathy, not certain if he himself was still employed. "I'll see what I can do." They talked about Colorado and the West and places Nate had never been. Chevy was in love with the mountains, and after 2 weeks in the Pantanal, Nate understood this. When it was time to go, they embraced warmly and said farewell. Nate walked across the hot pavement to the plane, carrying his entire wardrobe in a small gym bag. The turboprop with 20 seats landed twice before it reached Campo Grande. There the passengers boarded a jet for Sao Paulo. The lady in the seat next to him ordered a beer from the drink cart. Nate studied the can, less than 10 inches away. "Not anymore," he told himself. He closed his eyes and asked God to give him strength. He ordered coffee. The flight to Dulles left at midnight. It would arrive in D.C. at 9 the next morning. His search for Rachel had taken him out of the country for almost 3 weeks. He wasn't sure where his car was. He had no place to live and no means to get one. But he couldn't worry. Josh would take care of the details. The plane dropped through the clouds at 9,000 feet. Nate was awake, sipping coffee, dreading the streets of home. The streets were cold and white. The earth was blanketed by a heavy snow. It was lovely for a few minutes as they approached Dulles. Then Nate remembered how much he hated the winter. He wore a thin pair of trousers, no socks, cheap sneakers, and a fake polo shirt he'd paid $6 for in the Sao Paulo airport. He had no coat. He would sleep somewhere that night, probably in a hotel, unsupervised in D.C. for the first time since August 4th, the night he'd staggered into a suburban motel room. It had happened at the bottom of a long, pathetic crash. He'd worked hard to forget it. But that was the old Nate, and now there was a new one. He was 48 years old, 13 months away from 50, and ready for a different life. God had fortified him and strengthened his resolve. He had 30 years left. They wouldn't be spent clutching empty bottles, nor would they be spent on the run. Snowplows raced about as they taxied to the terminal. The runways were wet, and flurries were still falling. When Nate stepped off the plane into the tunnel, winter hit him, and he thought of the humid streets of Corumbá. Josh was waiting at the baggage claim, and, of course, he had an extra overcoat. "You look awful," were his first words. "Thanks." Nate grabbed the coat and put it on. "You're skinny as a rail." "You want to lose 15 pounds, find the right mosquito." They moved with a mob toward the exits, bodies jostling and bumping, a shove here, a push there, the throng squeezing tighter to fit through doors. "Welcome home," he said to himself. "You're traveling light," Josh said, pointing at his gym bag. "My worldly possessions." With no socks or gloves, Nate was freezing on the curb by the time Josh found him with the car. The snowstorm had hit during the night and had attained the status of a blizzard. Against the buildings, the drifts had reached 2 feet. "It was 93 yesterday in Corumbá," Nate said as they left the airport.
"Don't tell me you miss it."
"I do. Suddenly I do." Look, Gail is in London. I thought you could stay at our place for a couple of days. Josh's house could sleep 15. Sure, thanks. Where's my car? In my garage. Of course it was. It was a leased Jaguar, and it no doubt had been properly serviced, washed, and waxed, and the monthly payments were current. Thanks, Josh. I put your furnishings in a mini-storage. Your clothes and personal effects are packed in the car. Thanks. Nate was not at all surprised. How do you feel? I'm fine. Look, Nate, I've read about dengue fever. It takes a month to fully recover. Level with me. A month. It was the opening jab in the fight over Nate's future with the firm. Take another month, old boy. Maybe you're too ill to work. Nate could write the script. But there would be no fight. I'm a little weak, that's all. I'm sleeping a lot, drinking a lot of liquids. What kind of liquids? Get right to the point, don't you? I always do. I'm clean, Josh. Relax. No stumbles. Josh had heard that many times. The exchange had been a bit sharper than both men wanted, so they rode in silence for a while. The traffic was slow. The Potomac was half frozen, with large chunks of ice floating slowly toward Georgetown. Stalled in traffic on the chain bridge, Nate announced matter-of-factly, "I'm not going back to the office, Josh. Those days are over." There was no visible reaction from Josh. He could have been disappointed because an old friend and fine litigator was calling it quits. He could have been delighted because a major headache was quietly leaving the firm. He could have been indifferent because Nate's exit was probably inevitable. The tax evasion mess would ultimately cost him his license anyway. So he simply asked, "Why?" "Lots of reasons, Josh. Let's just say I'm tired." "Most litigators burn out after 20 years." "So I've heard." Enough of the retirement talk. Nate's mind was made up, and Josh didn't want to change it. The Super Bowl was 2 weeks away, and the Redskins were not in it. They seized the topic of football, as men usually do when they have to keep the conversation going in the midst of weightier matters. Even under a heavy layer of snow, the streets looked mean to Nate. The Staffords owned a large manor house in Wesley Heights, in northwest D.C. They also had a cottage on the Chesapeake and a cabin in Maine. The four kids were grown and scattered. Mrs. Stafford preferred to travel, while her husband preferred to work. Nate retrieved some warm clothes from the trunk of his car, then enjoyed a hot shower in the guest quarters. The water pressure was weaker in Brazil. The shower in his hotel room was never hot and never cold. The bars of soap were smaller. He compared the things around him. He was amused at the thought of the shower on the Santa Laura, a cord above the toilet that, when pulled, delivered lukewarm river water from a showerhead. He was tougher than he thought. The adventure had taught him that much. He shaved and then worked on his teeth, going about his habits with great deliberation. In many ways, it was nice to be home. Josh's office in his basement was larger than the one downtown, and just as cluttered. They met there for coffee. It was time to debrief. Nate began with the ill-fated effort to find Rachel by air, the crash landing, the dead cow, the three little boys, the bleakness of Christmas and the Pantanal. With great detail, he recounted the story of his ride on the horse and the encounter in the swamp with the curious alligator. Then the rescue by helicopter. He said nothing about the binge on Christmas night. It would serve no purpose, and he was terribly ashamed of it. He described Chevy, Welly, the Santa Laura, and the trip north. When he and Chevy were lost in the John boat, he remembered being frightened, but too busy to be consumed with fear. Now, in the safety of civilization, their wandering seemed terrifying. Josh was astounded by the adventure. He wanted to apologize for sending Nate into such a treacherous place, but the excursion had obviously been exciting. The alligators grew as the narrative continued. The lone anaconda sunning by the river was joined by another that swam near their boat. Nate described the Indians, their nakedness and bland food and languid lives, the chief and his refusal to let them leave. And Rachel. At that point in the debriefing, Josh took his legal pad and began writing notes. Nate portrayed her in great detail, from her soft, slow voice to her sandals and hiking boots, her hut and medicine bag, Laco and his limp, and the way the Indians looked at her when she walked by. He told the story of the child who died from the snake bite. He relayed what little of her history she'd given him. With the precision of a courtroom veteran, Nate covered everything about Rachel that he'd gathered on his visit. He used her exact words when talking about the money and the paperwork. He remembered her comment about how primitive Troy's handwritten will looked. Nate recounted what little he remembered of their retreat from the Pantanal, and he downplayed the horror of dengue fever. He had survived, and that in itself surprised him. A maid brought soup and hot tea for lunch. "Here's where we are," Josh said after a few spoonfuls. "If she rejects the gift under Troy's will, then the money remains in his estate. If, however, the will is found to be invalid for any reason, then there is no will." "How can the will be invalid? They had psychiatrists talking to him minutes before he jumped." "Now there are more psychiatrists, well paid and with different opinions. It'll get messy. All of his prior wills were shredded. If it's one day found that he died with no valid will, then his children, all seven of them, will share equally in his estate. Since Rachel doesn't want a share, then hers will be divided by the other six."
"Those fools will get $1 billion each."
"Something like that."
"What are the chances of striking down his will?"
"Not good. I'd rather have our case than theirs, but things can change."
Nate walked around the room, nibbling on a saltine, weighing the issues. "Why fight for the validity of the will if Rachel declines everything?"
"Three reasons," Josh said quickly. As usual, he had analyzed everything from all possible angles. There was a master plan, and it would be revealed to Nate piece by piece. "First, and most important, my client prepared a valid will. It gave away his assets exactly as he wanted. I, as his lawyer, have no choice but to fight to protect the integrity of the will. Second, I know how Mr. Phelan felt about his children. He was horrified that they would somehow get their hands on his money. I share his feelings about them, and I shudder to think what would happen if they got $1 billion each. Third, there's always a chance Rachel will change her mind."
"Don't count on it."
"Look, Nate, she's only human. She has those papers with her. She'll wait a few days and start to think about them. Maybe thoughts of wealth have never entered her mind, but at some point she has to think of all the good things she could do with the money. Did you explain trusts and charitable foundations to her?"
"I barely know what those are myself, Josh. I was a litigator, remember?"
"We're going to fight to protect Mr. Phelan's will, Nate. Problem is, the biggest seat at the table is empty. Rachel needs representation."
"No, she doesn't. She's oblivious."
"The litigation can't proceed until she has a lawyer."
Nate was no match for the master strategist. The black hole opened from nowhere, and he was already falling into it. He closed his eyes and said,
"You must be kidding."
"No. And we can't delay much longer. Troy died a month ago. Judge Wycliffe is desperate to know the whereabouts of Rachel Lane. Six lawsuits have been filed contesting the will, and there's a lot of pressure behind them. Everything gets reported in the papers. If we give any hint that Rachel plans to decline the bequest, then we lose control. The Phelan heirs and their lawyers go crazy. The judge suddenly loses interest in upholding Troy's last testament."
"So I'm her lawyer."
"There's no way around it, Nate. If you're quitting, that's fine, but you have to take one last case. Just sit at the table and protect her interests. We'll do the heavy lifting."
"But there's a conflict. I'm a partner in your firm."
It's a minor conflict, because our interests are the same. We, the estate, and Rachel have the same goal of protecting the will. We sit at the same table. And technically, we can claim you left the firm last August. There's a lot of truth in that. Both acknowledged the sad truth. Josh sipped his tea, his eyes never leaving Nate. At some point, we go to Wycliffe and tell him that you found Rachel, that she plans to make no appearance at this time, that she is not sure what to do, but that she wants you to protect her interests. Then we'll be lying to the judge. It's a small lie, Nate, and he'll thank us for it later. He's anxious to start proceedings, but he can't until he hears from Rachel. If you're her lawyer, the war begins. I'll do the lying. So I'm a one-man office working on my last case. Right. I'm leaving town, Josh. I'm not staying. Nate said this, then he laughed. Where would I stay? Where are you going? I don't know. I haven't thought that far ahead. I have an idea. I'm sure you do. Take my cottage on Chesapeake Bay. We don't use it in the wintertime. It's at St. Michael's, 2 hours away. You can drive in when you need it and stay here. Again, Nate, we'll do the work. Nate studied the bookshelves for a while. 24 hours earlier, he'd been eating a sandwich on a park bench in Corumbá, watching the pedestrians and waiting for Rachel to appear. He had vowed to never again voluntarily step into a courtroom. But he grudgingly admitted that the plan had its strong points. He certainly couldn't imagine a better client. The case would never go to trial. And with the money at stake, he could at least earn a living for a few months. Josh finished his soup and moved to the next item on the list. I propose a fee of $10,000 a month. That's generous, Josh. I think we can squeeze it from the old man's estate. With no overhead, it'll get you back on your feet. Until we settle with the IRS. Any word from the judge? I call him occasionally. We had lunch last week. So he's your buddy? We've known each other for a long time. Forget jail, Nate. The government will settle for a big fine and a 5-year suspension of your law license. They can have my law license. Not yet. We need it for one more case. How long will the government wait? 1 year. It's not a priority. Thanks, Josh. Nate was tired again. The all-night flight, the ravages of the jungle, the mental jousting with Josh. He wanted a warm, soft bed in a dark room. Chapter 39. At 6 Sunday morning, Nate finished another hot shower, his third in 24 hours, and began making plans for a quick departure. One night in the city, and he was anxious to leave. The cottage on the bay was calling him. D.C. had been his home for 26 years, and since the decision to leave had been made, he was eager to move on. With no address, moving was easy. He found Josh in the basement at his desk on the phone with a client in Thailand. As Nate listened to one half of the conversation about natural gas deposits, he was quite happy to be leaving the practice of law. Josh was 12 years older, a very rich man, and his idea of fun was to be at his desk at 6:30 on a Sunday morning. "Don't let it happen to me," Nate said to himself. But he knew it wouldn't. If he went back to the office, he would return to the grind. 4 rehabs meant a fifth was somewhere down the road. He wasn't as strong as Josh. He'd be dead in 10 years. There was an element of excitement in walking away. Suing doctors was a nasty business, one he could do without. Nor would he miss the stress of a high-powered office. He'd had his career, his triumphs. Success had brought him nothing but misery. He couldn't handle it. Success had thrown him in the gutter. Now that the horror of jail had been removed, he could enjoy a new life. He left with a trunkload of clothes, leaving the rest in a box in Josh's garage. The snow had stopped, but the plows were still catching up. The streets were slick. and after two blocks it occurred to Nate that he had not held the wheel of a car in over 5 months. There was no traffic, though, and he crept along Wisconsin into Chevy Chase, then onto the beltway where the ice and snow had been cleared. Alone, in his own fine car, he began to feel like an American again. He thought of Chevy and his loud, dangerous Ford truck, and wondered how long he would last on the beltway. And he thought of Welly, a kid so poor his family owned no car. Nate planned to write letters in the days to come, and he would send one to his buddies in Corumba. The phone caught his attention. He picked it up. It appeared to be working. Of course, Josh had made sure the bills were paid. He called Sergio at home, and they talked for 20 minutes. He got scolded for not calling sooner. Sergio had been worried. He explained the situation with telephone service in the Pantanal. Things were going in a different direction. There were some unknowns, but his adventure was continuing. He was leaving the profession and avoiding jail. Sergio never asked about sobriety. Nate certainly sounded clean and strong. He gave him the number at the cottage, and they promised to have lunch soon. He called his oldest son at Northwestern in Evanston and left a message on the recorder. Where would a 23-year-old grad student be at 7 a.m. on a Sunday morning? Not at early mass. Nate didn't want to know. Whatever his son was doing, he would never screw up as badly as his father. His daughter was 21, an on-again, off-again student at Pitt. Their last conversation had been about tuition, a day before Nate checked into the motel room with a bottle of rum and a sack full of pills. He couldn't find her phone number. Their mother had remarried twice since leaving Nate. She was an unpleasant person, whom he called only when absolutely necessary. He would wait a couple of days, then ask her for their daughter's phone number. He was determined to make the painful trip west, to Oregon, to at least see his two youngest children. Their mother had remarried, too, remarkably to another lawyer, but one who evidently lived a clean life. He would ask them for forgiveness, and try to establish the frail beginnings of a relationship. He wasn't sure how to do this, but he vowed to try. In Annapolis, he stopped at a cafe and had breakfast. He listened to the weather predictions from a group of rowdy regulars in a booth, and he mindlessly scanned the Post. From the headlines and late-breaking stories, Nate saw nothing that interested him in the least. The news never changed. Trouble in the Middle East, trouble in Ireland, scandals in Congress. The markets were up, then down. An oil spill, another AIDS drug, guerrillas killing peasants in Latin America, turmoil in Russia. His clothes hung loose on him, so he ate 3 eggs with bacon and biscuits. A shaky consensus emerged from the booth that more snow was on the way. He crossed the Chesapeake on the Bay Bridge. The highways on the eastern shore had not been plowed well. The Jaguar skidded twice, and he slowed down. The car was a year old, and he couldn't remember when the lease expired. His secretary had handled the paperwork. He'd picked the color. He decided to get rid of it as soon as possible and find an old four-wheel drive. The fancy lawyer's car had once seemed so important. Now, he had no need for it. At Easton, he turned onto State Route 33, a road with 2 inches of loose snow still resting on the blacktop. Nate followed the tracks of other vehicles and soon passed through sleepy little settlements with harbors filled with sailboats. The shores of the Chesapeake were covered with heavy snow. Its waters were deep blue. St. Michael's had a population of 1,300. Route 33 became Main Street for a few blocks as it ran through the town. There were shops and stores on both sides, old buildings side by side, all well preserved and ready for the postcard. Nate had heard of St. Michael's all his life. There was a maritime museum, an oyster festival, an active harbor, dozens of quaint little bed and breakfasts which attracted city folks for long weekends. He passed the post office and a small church, where the rector was shoveling snow from the front steps. The cottage was on Green Street, 2 blocks off Main, facing north with a view of the harbor. It was Victorian, with twin gables and a long front porch that wrapped around to the sides. Painted slate blue with white and yellow trim, the house had snowdrifts almost to the front door. The front lawn was small, the driveway under 2 feet of snow. Nate parked at the curb and fought his way to the porch. He flipped on lights inside as he walked to the rear. In a closet by the back door, he found a plastic shovel. He spent a wonderful hour cleaning the porch, clearing the drive and sidewalk, working his way back to his car. Not surprisingly, the house was richly decorated with period pieces, and it was tidy and organized. Josh said a maid came every Wednesday to dust and clean. Mrs. Stafford stayed there for 2 weeks in the spring and one in the fall. Josh had slept there 3 nights in the past 18 months. There were 4 bedrooms and 4 baths, some cottage. But there was no coffee to be found, and this presented the first emergency of the day. Nate locked the doors and headed for town. The sidewalks were clear and wet from melting snow. According to the thermometer in the window of the barber shop, the temperature was 35 degrees. The shops and stores were closed. Nate studied their windows as he ambled along. Ahead, the church bells began. According to the bulletin handed to Nate by the elderly usher, the rector was Father Phil Lancaster, a short, wiry little man with thick, horn-rimmed glasses and curly hair that was red and gray. He could have been 35 or 50. His flock for the 11 o'clock service was old and thin, no doubt hampered by the weather. Nate counted 21 people in the small sanctuary, and that included Phil and the organist. There were many gray heads. It was a handsome church, with a vaulted ceiling, pews and floors of dark wood, 4 windows of stained glass. When the lone usher took his seat in the back pew, Phil rose in his black robe and welcomed them to Trinity Church, where everyone was at home. His voice was high and nasal, and he needed no microphone. In his prayer, he thanked God for snow and winter, for the seasons given as reminders that he was always in control. They struggled through the hymns and prayers. When Father Phil preached, he noticed Nate, the sole visitor, sitting in the next-to-last row. They exchanged smiles, and for one scary moment, Nate was afraid he was about to be introduced to the small crowd. His sermon was on the subject of enthusiasm, an odd choice given the average age of his congregation. Nate struggled hard to pay attention, but began to drift. His thoughts returned to the little chapel in Corumbá, with the front doors open, the windows up, the heat drifting through, the dying Christ suffering on the cross, the young man with the guitar. Careful not to offend Phil, he managed to keep his eyes fixed on the globe of a dim light on the wall behind and above the pulpit. Given the thickness of the preacher's eyeglasses, he figured his disinterest would go unnoticed. Sitting in the warm little church, finally safe from the uncertainties of his great adventure, safe from fevers and storms, safe from the dangers of D.C., safe from his addictions, safe from spiritual extinction, Nate realized that for the first time in memory, he was at peace. He feared nothing. God was pulling him in some direction. He wasn't certain where, but he wasn't afraid either. Be patient, he told himself. Then he whispered a prayer. He thanked God for sparing his life, and he prayed for Rachel because he knew she was praying for him. The serenity made him smile. When the prayer was over, he opened his eyes and saw that Phil was smiling at him. After the benediction, they filed past Phil at the front door, each complimenting him on the sermon and mentioning some brief bit of church news. The line moved slowly. It was a ritual. "How's your aunt?" Phil asked one of his flock, then listened carefully as the aunt's latest affliction was described. "How's that hip?" he asked another. "How was Germany?" He clutched their hands and bent forward to hear every word. He knew what was on their minds. Nate waited patiently at the end of the line. There was no hurry. He had nothing else to do. "Welcome," Father Phil said as he grabbed Nate by the hand and arm. "Welcome to Trinity." He squeezed so tightly, Nate wondered if he were the first guest in years. "I'm Nate O'Reilly," he said, then added, "from Washington," as if that would help define him. "So nice to have you with us this morning," Phil said, his big eyes dancing behind the glasses. Up close, the wrinkles revealed that he was at least 50. His head had more gray curls than red. "I'm staying in the Stafford cottage for a few days," Nate said.
"Yes, yes, a lovely home. When did you arrive?"
"This morning."
"Are you alone?"
"Yes."
"Well, then you must join us for lunch."
The aggressive hospitality made Nate laugh. "Well, thanks, but..." Phil was all smiles, too.
"No, I insist. My wife makes a lamb stew every time it snows. It's on the stove now. We have so few guests in the wintertime. Please, the parsonage is just behind the church."
Nate was in the hands of a man who'd shared his Sunday table with hundreds.
"Really, I was just stopping by. And it's our pleasure," Phil said, already tugging at Nate's arm and leading him back toward the pulpit. "What do you do in Washington?"
"I'm a lawyer," Nate said. A complete answer would get complicated.
"What brings you here?"
"It's a long story."
"Oh, wonderful. Laura and I love stories. Let's have a long lunch and tell stories. We'll have a grand time."
His enthusiasm was irresistible. Poor guy was starved for fresh conversation. Why not? Thought Nate. There was no food in the cottage. All stores appeared to be closed. They passed the pulpit and went through a door leading to the rear of the church. Laura was turning off lights.
"This is Mr. O'Reilly from Washington," Phil said loudly to his wife. "He's agreed to join us for lunch."
Laura smiled and shook Nate's hand. She had short gray hair and looked at least 10 years older than her husband. If a sudden guest at the table surprised her, it wasn't evident. Nate got the impression it happened all the time. "Please call me Nate," he said.
"Nate it is," Phil announced, peeling off his robe.
The parsonage was adjacent to the church lot, facing a side street. They carefully stepped through the snow.
"How was my sermon?" Phil asked her as they stepped onto the porch. "Excellent, dear," she said, without a trace of enthusiasm.
Nate listened and smiled, certain that every Sunday for years Phil had asked the same question at the same place and time and received the same answer. Any hesitation about staying for lunch vanished when he stepped into the house. The rich, heavy aroma of the lamb stew wafted through the den. Phil poked at the orange coals in the fireplace while Laura prepared the meal. In the narrow dining room between the kitchen and the den, a table had been set for four. Nate was pleased that he had accepted their invitation, not that he had the chance to decline it.
"We're so glad you're here," Phil said as they took their seats. "I had a hunch we might have a guest today."
"Whose place is that?" Nate asked, nodding to the empty setting.
"We always set four places on Sunday," Laura said, and let the explanation go at that.
They held hands as Phil thanked God again for the snow and the seasons, and for the food. He concluded with,
"And keep us ever mindful of the needs and wants of others."
Those words triggered something in Nate's memory. He'd heard them before, many, many years before. As the food was passed around, there was the usual talk about the morning. They averaged 40 at the 11 o'clock service. The snow had indeed kept people away. And there was a flu bug on the peninsula. Nate complimented them on the simple beauty of the sanctuary. They had been in St. Michael's for 6 years. Not long into the lunch, Laura said,
"You have a nice tan for January. You didn't get that in Washington."
"No. I just returned from Brazil." They both stopped eating and leaned closer. The adventure was on again. Nate took a large spoonful of stew, which was thick and delicious, then began the story.
"Please eat," Laura said, every 5 minutes or so.
Nate took a bite, chewed slowly, then proceeded. He referred to Rachel only as the daughter of a client. The storms grew fiercer, the snakes longer, the boats smaller, the Indians less friendly. Phil's eyes danced with amazement as Nate went from chapter to chapter. It was the second time Nate had told the story since his return. Other than a slight exaggeration here and there, he kept to the facts. And it amazed even him. It was a remarkable story to tell, and his hosts got a long, rich version of it. They wedged in questions whenever they could. When Laura cleared the table and served brownies for dessert, Nate and Chevy had just arrived at the first Ipica settlement. "Was she surprised to see you?" Phil asked when Nate described the scene with the band of Indians leading the woman out of the village to meet them. "Not really," Nate said. "She seemed to know we were coming." Nate did his best to describe the Indians and their Stone Age culture, but words failed to deliver the right images. He ate two brownies, clearing his plate with large bites during brief gaps in the narrative. They pushed their plates away and had coffee. Sunday lunch for Phil and Laura was more about conversation than eating. Nate wondered who'd been the last guest lucky enough to be invited in for stories and food. It was hard to downplay the horrors of dengue, but Nate tried gamely. A couple of days in the hospital, some medication, and he was back on his feet. When he finished, the questions began. Phil wanted to know everything about the missionary, her denomination, her faith, her work with the Indians. Laura's sister had lived in China for 15 years, working in a church hospital, and this became the source of more stories. It was almost 3 o'clock when Nate made it to the door. His host would have gladly sat at the table or in the den and talked until dark, but Nate needed a walk. He thanked them for their hospitality, and when he left them waving on the porch, he felt as though he'd known them for years. It took an hour to walk St. Michael's. The streets were narrow and lined with homes 100 years old. Nothing was out of place. No stray dogs, vacant lots, abandoned buildings, even the snow was neat, carefully shoveled so that the streets and sidewalks were clear and no neighbor was offended. Nate stopped at the pier and admired the sailboats. He had never set foot on one. He decided he wouldn't leave St. Michael's until he was forced. He would live in the cottage and remain there until Josh politely evicted him. He would save his money, and when the Phelan matter was over, he would find some way to hang on. Near the harbor, he stumbled onto a small grocery about to close for the day. He bought coffee, canned soup, saltines, and oatmeal for breakfast. There was a display of bottled beer by the counter. He smiled at it, happy those days were behind him. Chapter 40. Grit got himself fired by fax and by email, a first for his office. Mary Ross did it to him early Monday morning, after a tense weekend with her brothers. Grit did not exit gracefully. He faxed her back and submitted a bill for his services to date, 148 hours at $600 per, for a total of $88,800. His hourly billings were to be applied against his percentage upon settlement or other favorable outcome. Grit didn't want $600 an hour. Grit wanted a piece of the pie, a healthy fraction of his client's cut, the 25% he'd negotiated. Grit wanted millions, and as he sat in his locked office staring at the facts, he found it impossible to believe that his fortune had slipped away. He truly believed that after a few months of hardball litigation, the Phelan estate would settle with the children. Throw $20 million at each of the six, watch them attack it like hungry dogs, and there wouldn't be the slightest dent in the Phelan fortune. $20 million to his client was $5 million to him, and Grit alone had to confess that he'd already thought of several ways to spend it. He called Hark's office to curse him, but was told Mr. Geddes was too busy at the moment. Mr. Geddes now had 3 of the 4 heirs from the first family. His percentage had dropped from 25 to 20 and now to 17.5, but his upside potential was enormous. Mr. Geddes walked into his conference room a few minutes after 10 and greeted the remaining Phelan lawyers gathered there for an important meeting. He cheerfully said, "I have an announcement. Mr. Gritt is no longer involved in this case. His ex-client, Mary Ross Phelan Jackman, has asked me to represent her, and after much consideration, I have agreed to do so." His words hit like small bombs around the conference table. Yancey stroked his scraggly beard and wondered what method of coercion had been used to pry the woman away from Gritt's tentacles. He felt somewhat safe, though. Ramble's mother had used every means possible to lure the kid to another lawyer, but the kid hated his mother. Madame Langhorne was surprised, especially since Hark had just added Troy Jr. as a client. But after the brief shock, she felt secure. Her client, Gina Phelan Strong, detested her older half-brothers and sisters. Surely she wouldn't throw in with their lawyer. Nonetheless, a power lunch was needed. She would call Gina and Cody when the meeting was over. They'd dine at the promenade near the Capitol and maybe catch a glimpse of a powerful subcommittee vice chairman. The back of Wally Bright's neck turned scarlet with the news. Hark was raiding clients, chasing ambulances. Only Libigail remained from the first family, and Wally Bright would kill Hark if he tried to steal her. "Stay away from my client, okay?" he said loudly and bitterly, and the entire room froze. "Relax." "Relax my ass? How can we relax when you're stealing clients?"
"I didn't steal Mrs. Jackman. She called me. I didn't call her."
"We know the game you're playing, Hark. We're not stupid." Wally said this while looking at his fellow lawyers. They certainly didn't consider themselves to be stupid, but they weren't so sure about Wally. Truth was, no one could trust anyone. There was simply too much money at stake to assume that the lawyer next to you would not pull out a knife. They led Sneed in, and this changed the focus of the discussion. Hark introduced him to the group. Poor Sneed looked like a man facing a firing squad. He sat at the end of the table with two video cameras aimed at him. "This is just a rehearsal," Hark assured him. "Relax." The lawyers pulled out legal pads covered with questions, and they inched closer to Sneed. Hark walked behind him, patted him on the shoulder, and said, "Now, when you give your deposition, Mr. Sneed, the lawyers for the other side will be allowed to interrogate you first. So for the next hour or so, you are to assume that we are the enemy. Okay?" It certainly wasn't okay with Sneed, but he'd taken their money. He had to play along. Hark picked up his legal pad and began asking questions, simple things about his birth, background, family, school, easy stuff that Sneed handled well and relaxed with. Then the early years with Mr. Phelan, and 1,000 questions that seemed completely irrelevant. After a bathroom break, Madame Langhorne took the baton and grilled Sneed about the Phelan families, the wives, the kids, the divorces, and mistresses. Sneed thought it was a lot of unnecessary dirt, but the lawyers seemed to enjoy it. "Did you know about Rachel Lane?" Langhorne asked. Sneed pondered this for a moment, then said, "I haven't thought about that. In other words, help me with the answer. What would you guess?" he asked Mr. Geddes. Hark was quick with the fiction. "I would guess that you knew everything about Mr. Phelan, especially his women and their offspring. Nothing escaped you. The old man confided everything in you, including the existence of his illegitimate daughter. She was 10 or 11 when you went to work for Mr. Phelan. He tried to reach out to her over the years, but she would have nothing to do with him. I would guess that this hurt him deeply, that he was a man who got whatever he wanted, and when Rachel spurned him, his pain turned to anger. I would guess that he disliked her immensely. Thus, for him to leave her everything was an act of sheer insanity." Once again, Sneed marveled at Hark's ability to spin tales so quickly. The other lawyers were impressed, too.
"What do you think?" Hark asked them.
They nodded their approvals.
"Better get him all the background on Rachel Lane," Bright said.
Sneed then repeated for the cameras the same story Hark had just told, and in doing so showed a passable skill at expanding on a theme. When he finished, the lawyers couldn't suppress their pleasure. The worm would say anything, and there was no one to contradict it. When Sneed was asked a question that needed assistance, he responded by saying, "Well, I haven't thought about that." The lawyers would then reach out to help. Hark, who seemed to anticipate Sneed's weaknesses, usually had a quick narrative at hand. Often, though, the other lawyers chimed in with their little plots, all anxious to display their skills at lying. Layer upon layer was fabricated and fine-tuned, carefully molded to ensure that Mr. Phelan was out of his mind the morning he scrawled his last testament. Sneed was coached by the lawyers, and he proved quite easy to lead. In fact, he was so coachable the lawyers worried that he might say too much. His credibility could not be damaged. There could be no holes in his testimony. For 3 hours they built his story. Then for 2 hours they tried to tear it down with relentless cross-examination. They didn't feed him lunch. They sneered at him and called him a liar. At one point Langhorne had him near tears. When he was exhausted and ready to collapse, they sent him home with a pack of videos and instructions to study them over and over. He wasn't ready to testify, they told him. His stories weren't airtight. Poor Sneed drove home in his new Range Rover, tired and bewildered, but also determined to practice his lies until the lawyers applauded him. Judge Wycliffe enjoyed the quiet little lunches in his office. As usual, Josh picked up sandwiches from a Greek deli near DuPont Circle. He unpacked them, along with iced tea and pickles, on the small table in a corner. They huddled over their food, at first talking about how busy they were, then quickly getting around to the Phelan estate. Something was up, or Josh wouldn't have called.
"We found Rachel Lane," he said.
"Wonderful. Where?" The relief in Wycliffe's face was obvious.
"She made us promise not to tell, at least not now."
"Is she in the country?" The judge forgot about his corned beef on Kaiser.
"No. She's in a very remote spot in the world and quite content to stay there."
"How did you find her?"
"Her lawyer found her."
"Who's her lawyer?"
"A guy who used to work in my firm. Name's Nate O'Reilly, a former partner. Left us back in August."
Wycliffe narrowed his eyes and considered this. "What a coincidence. She hires a former partner of the law firm her father used."
"There's no coincidence. As the attorney for the estate, I had to find her. I sent Nate O'Reilly. He found her, she hired him. It's really pretty simple."
"When does she make her appearance?"
"I doubt if she'll do it in person."
"What about the acknowledgement and waiver?"
"They're coming. She's very deliberate, and frankly, I'm not sure what her plans are."
"We have a will contest, Josh. The war has already erupted. Things can't wait. This court must have jurisdiction over her."
"Judge, she has legal representation. Her interests will be protected. Let's fight. We'll start discovery and see what the other side has."
"Can I talk to her?"
"It's impossible."
"Come on, Josh."
"I swear. Look, she's a missionary in a very remote place, in a different hemisphere. That's all I can tell you."
"I want to see Mr. O'Reilly."
"When?"
Wycliffe walked to his desk and grabbed the nearest appointment book. He was so busy. Life was regulated by a docket calendar, a trial calendar, a motion calendar. His secretary kept an office calendar. "How about this Wednesday?"
"Fine. For lunch? Just the three of us, off the record?"
"Sure." Lawyer O'Reilly had planned to read and write throughout the morning. His plans were diverted, though, with a phone call from the rector.
"Are you busy?" Father Phil asked, his strong voice resonating over the phone.
"Well, no, not really," Nate said. He was sitting in a deep leather chair under a quilt beside the fire, sipping coffee and reading Mark Twain.
"Are you sure?"
"Of course I'm sure."
"Well, I'm at the church working in the basement doing some remodeling, and I need a hand. I thought you might be bored, you know, since there's not much to do here in St. Michael's, at least not in the winter. It's supposed to snow again today."
The lamb stew crossed Nate's mind. There was plenty of it left over. "I'll be there in 10 minutes." The basement was directly under the sanctuary. Nate heard hammering as he carefully descended the shaky steps. It was an open room, long and wide with a low ceiling. A remodeling project had been underway for a long time, with no end in sight. The general plan appeared to be a series of small rooms against the outer walls, with an open space in the center. Phil stood between two sawhorses, tape measure in hand, sawdust on his shoulders. He wore a flannel shirt, jeans, boots, and would have easily passed for a carpenter.
"Thanks for coming," he said with a big smile.
"You're welcome. I was bored," Nate said.
"I'm hanging wallboard," he said, waving his arm at the construction. "It's easier if there are two people. Mr. Fuqua used to help, but he's 80 now, and his back is not what it used to be."
"What are you building?"
6 classrooms for Bible study. This center area will be a fellowship hall. I started 2 years ago. Our budget doesn't allow much in the way of new projects, so I'm doing it myself. Keeps me in shape."
Father Phil hadn't been in shape in years.
"Point me in the right direction," Nate said. "And remember, I'm a lawyer."
"Not a lot of honest work, huh?"
"No."
They each took an end of a sheet of wallboard and wrestled it across the floor to the current classroom in progress. The sheet was 4 feet by 6, and as they lifted it into place, Nate realized that it was indeed a job for 2 people. Phil grunted and frowned and bit his tongue, and when the piece fit the puzzle, he said, "Now, just hold it right there." Nate pressed the board against the 2x4 studs while Phil quickly tacked it into place with sheetrock nails. Once secure, he drove 6 more nails into the studs and admired his handiwork. Then he produced a tape and began to measure the next open space.
"Where did you learn to be a carpenter?" Nate asked as he watched with interest.
"It's in my blood. Joseph was a carpenter."
"Who's he?"
"The father of Jesus."
"Oh, that Joseph."
"Do you read the Bible, Nate?"
"Not much."
"You should."
"I'd like to start."
"I can help you if you want."
"Thanks."
Phil scribbled dimensions on the wallboard they had just installed. He measured carefully, then remeasured. Before long, Nate realized why the project was taking so long. Phil took his time and believed in a vigorous regimen of coffee breaks. After an hour, they walked up the stairs to the main floor, to the rector's office, which was 10 degrees warmer than the basement. Phil had a pot of strong coffee on a small burner. He poured 2 cups and began scanning the rows of books on the shelves.
"Here's a wonderful daily devotional guide, one of my favorites," he said, gently removing the book, wiping it as if it were covered in dust, then handing it to Nate. It was a hardback with the dust jacket intact. Phil was particular about his books.
He selected another and handed it to Nate.
"This is a Bible study for busy people. It's very good."
"What makes you think I'm busy?"
"You're a lawyer in Washington, aren't you?"
"Technically, but those days are about to be over."
Phil tapped his fingertips together and looked at Nate as only a minister can. His eyes said, "Keep going. Tell me more. I'm here to help." So Nate unloaded some of his troubles, past and present, with emphasis on the pending showdown with the IRS and the imminent loss of his law license. He would avoid jail, but be required to pay a fine he couldn't afford. Nonetheless, he wasn't unhappy about the future. In fact, he was relieved to be leaving the profession.
"What will you do?" Phil asked.
"I have no idea." Do you trust God?
Yes, I think so.
Then relax. He'll show you the way.
They talked long enough to stretch the morning to the lunch hour, then walked next door and feasted once again on the lamb stew. Laura joined them late. She taught kindergarten and only had 30 minutes for lunch. Around 2, they made it back to the basement where they reluctantly resumed their labor. Watching Phil work, Nate became convinced that the project would not be finished in his lifetime. Joseph may have been a fine carpenter, but Father Phil belonged in the pulpit. Every open space on the wall had to be measured, remeasured, pondered over, looked at from various angles, then measured again. The sheet of wallboard destined to fill the open space went through the same procedures. Finally, after enough pencil markings to confuse an architect, Phil, with great trepidation, took the electric saw and cut the wallboard. They carried the sheet to the open space, tacked it, then secured it. The fit was always perfect, and with each one Phil seemed genuinely relieved. 2 classrooms appeared to be finished and ready for paint. Late in the afternoon, Nate decided that tomorrow he would become a painter. Chapter 41 2 days of pleasant labor yielded little progress in the chilly basement of Trinity Church, but much coffee was consumed. The lamb stew was finally finished. Some paint and wallboard fell into place, and a friendship was built. Nate was scraping paint from his fingernails Tuesday night when the phone rang. It was Josh, calling him back to the real world.
"Judge Wycliffe wants to see you tomorrow," he said. "I tried to call earlier."
"What does he want?" Nate asked, his voice flat with dread.
"I'm sure he'll have questions about your new client."
"I'm really busy, Josh. I'm into remodeling, painting, and sheetrock, stuff like that."
"Oh, really?"
"Yeah, I'm doing the basement of a church. Time is of the essence."
"Didn't know you had such talents."
"Do I have to come, Josh?"
"I think so, pal. You agreed to take the case. I've already told the judge. You're needed, old boy."
"When and where?"
"Come to my office at 11. We'll ride over together."
"I don't want to see the office, Josh. It's all bad memories. I'll just meet you at the courthouse."
"Fine. Be there at noon, Judge Wycliffe's office."
Nate put a log on the fire and watched the snow flurries float across the porch. He could put on a suit and tie and carry a briefcase around. He could look and talk the part. He could say, "Your Honor," and "May it please the court," and he could yell objections and grill witnesses. He could do all the things a million others did, but he no longer considered himself a lawyer. Those days were gone, thank God. He could do it once more, but only once. He tried to convince himself it was for his client, for Rachel, but he knew she didn't care. He still hadn't written her, though he'd planned the letter many times. The one to Chevy had required 2 hours of hard work for a page and a half. After 3 days in the snow, he missed the humid streets of Corumbá, with the lazy pedestrian traffic, the outdoor cafes, the pace of life that said everything could wait until tomorrow. It was snowing harder by the minute. "Maybe it's another blizzard," he thought, "and the roads will be closed, and I won't have to go after all." More sandwiches from the Greek deli, more pickles and tea. Josh prepared the table as they waited for Judge Wycliffe. "Here's the court file," he said, handing a bulky red binder to Nate. "And here's your response," he said, handing over a manila file. "You need to read and sign this as soon as possible." "Has the estate filed an answer?" Nate asked. "Tomorrow. The answer of Rachel Lane is in there, already prepared, just waiting for your signature." "There's something wrong here, Josh. I'm filing an answer to a will contest on behalf of a client who doesn't know it."
"Send her a copy."
"To where?"
"To her only known address, that of World Tribes Missions in Houston, Texas. It's all in the file."
Nate shook his head in frustration at Josh's preparations. He felt like a pawn on a game board. The answer of the proponent, Rachel Lane, was 4 pages long and denied, both generally and specifically, the allegations set forth in the 6 petitions challenging the will. Nate read the 6 petitions while Josh worked his cell phone. When all the rash allegations and legalese were pared down, it was a simple case. Did Troy Phelan know what he was doing when he wrote his last testament? The trial would be a circus, though, with the lawyers trotting in psychiatrists of every sort and species. Employees, ex-employees, old girlfriends, janitors, maids, chauffeurs, pilots, bodyguards, doctors, prostitutes, anybody who'd spent 5 minutes with the old man would be hauled in to testify. Nate didn't have the stomach for it. The file grew heavier as he read. It would fill a room when the war was finally over. Judge Wycliffe made his usual fussy entrance at 12:30, apologizing for being so busy while yanking off his robe. "You're Nate O'Reilly," he said, thrusting forth a hand. "Yes, Judge. A pleasure to meet you." Josh managed to disengage himself from the cell phone. They squeezed around the small table and began eating. "Josh tells me you found the richest woman in the world," Wycliffe said, smacking his food. "Yes, I did. About 2 weeks ago." "And you can't tell me where she is?" "She begged me not to. I promised." "Will she appear and testify at the appropriate time?" "She won't have to," Josh explained. Of course, he had a brief, a Stafford memo, in his file on the issue of her presence during the lawsuit. "If she knows nothing about Mr. Phelan's mental capacity, she can't be a witness." "But she's a party," Wycliffe said. "Yes, she is. But her presence can be excused. We can litigate without her."
"Excused by whom?"
"You, Your Honor." "I plan to file a motion at the appropriate time," Nate said, "asking the court to allow the trial to be held without her presence." Josh smiled across the table. "Attaboy, Nate."
"I guess we'll worry about it later," Wycliffe said. "I'm more concerned about discovery. Needless to say, the contestants are quite anxious to move ahead."
"The estate will file its answer tomorrow," Josh said. "We're ready for battle."
"What about the proponent?"
"I'm still working on her answer," Nate said somberly, as if he'd labored days on it. "But I can file it tomorrow."
"Are you ready for discovery?"